You are listening to episode 133 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, fast as the blink of an eye, beat of a heartbeat, or tweet.
Episode 133 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April the 13th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my tax-evading brother, James Furlough.
I did not evade my taxes this year, because the government owes me money, so I made sure to file.
Nice. If you don't mind me asking, you know, where we'll publish to the entire world, and anybody can find it whenever, how much are you getting back?
It's not much. It's like $2,500. Something like that.
Yeah, that's not much at all. I'm getting back like, I think it's like 60. No, wait. That's how much I'm paying. I'm paying
$60. That's not bad.
It's not bad. It's not good. It's actually just kind of highly annoying, really and truly. Thankfully, it comes out in the wash because California owes me like 70 bucks, so it all comes out to like a total of a $10 exchange. It's like it didn't even happen, which I don't know. I just kind of...
Now, last year, we made out ridiculously well because we spent way too much money fixing up places. And so we lost a lot of money is what that comes down to.
Yeah.
But the upside was we had a huge check, which is what we used to buy the house I'm currently sitting in. So there was that. This year it will all 100% be going towards student loans, and then next year, or I guess this year, it's always weird to think about it, we don't have any large projects planned, and so I suspect that I will owe money next year.
Bummer.
Which is okay. It has good implications behind it.
Yeah. See, my thing is, like, I've realized that there's absolutely nothing that I do that the government tries to incentivize, which is kind of weird to think about. Like, I live my entire life, and I have, like, a single deduction, and at the end of the year, I owe nothing, and they owe me nothing, and we're all even. Everything's cool. Good job. Yeah. Nice job, guys. Another year down. I don't even know what that means. Like,
so,
my taxes couldn't be simpler.
Like, my recommendation to everybody is to start a side business because the government likes you a lot. So, like, for example, because of that, we itemize all of our deductions. So, like, whenever we give to, say, like, our church or to Goodwill, that all counts towards it, where most people who are just working, they get the standard deduction, which is what you got. And so...
I've been saving up all
giving
my,
doesn't matter.
I've been saving up all my giving stuff because you can save it up to like 5 years if you don't have anything for like itemized deductions. It's been like 3 years and it still is worth less than the standard deduction. And like I feel like that makes me sound like I don't give
standard anything. Deduction's awesome.
yeah, that's what it comes down to is the stand. Like I said, there's just nothing that they care about that I do. Like, nope, we don't care if you do that. You're not big enough. You're not important. Oh, I want to be important, government.
So the real question is, what was your effective tax rate?
Oh, geez.
That's the real question. That's where it's fun to compare. Because at least our accountants would do that math for us at the bottom of it. So we know. This is fun, just like publicly putting it out there.
Yeah, seriously.
This is the kind of stuff that I wish people talked about more, because it's like, man, I'd like to know. Which, I had a fun discussion.
Yeah, you do that, because I got to... You tell me about it, because I got to do math.
While we were at lunch one day, and a Mr. David Perry, who listeners of this podcast will know, brought up a great subject one day. He was like, let's talk about tipping. How much... And when do you tip? And we literally went around the table and everyone just kind of like put it out there. Turns out I'm kind of cheap. I know that's not a surprise.
I'm going to throw this out there, but I'm not shocked.
But my guess is that you might be kind of cheap too.
Okay.
I was not, for me, I'm like 15% and I tend to not round because I know how to do math. And so, so that's what I do. And I'll do it at restaurants, and then I'll give a couple bucks for a haircut. And then Jesse always has to kick me whenever we get a ride somewhere. I'm like, oh man, yeah, that's right. I don't have any cash, but I'm supposed to tip. That's right. And then there were other people who are like, I do 20% rounded up to the nearest 50. And that's for, they're like, I don't care if it's fast food or sit down restaurant, for a haircut, for, they're like anything that is service related. Their even rule of thumb is like, I tip for a hotel room. I leave money for the maids. And I'm like, wow, I didn't even know you could do that. That wasn't even on my radar as a possibility. So I was like, man, you are a very generous person. So I'm generous in other ways, just not tipping. But
this is not tax. Well, you know, it's funny. I think of taxing as paying for a service. I really do. I don't think of it as generosity. I think of it as I tip based on an expected relationship that we're building, right? For me, it's like if it's a restaurant I go to regularly and I'm served by the same person regularly, I tip better. Since bars tend to be very regular in who's the bartender and how you build a relationship, I tend to tip very well. If I spend less than $25 at a bar, I tip 50%. But I get free beers relatively regularly. As a result, you know, if I spend above $25, it starts to come down, and, you know, and the dumber the night gets, the more reasonable my tip becomes. To an extent, at some point you're drunk enough where it gets unreasonable again. I try not to do desperately. I haven't done that in a long time, but for food, I tend to do 20%. Depending on the service.
Now you gotta worry about sales tax. Is that before or after sales tax?
I do 10% on the base. I don't include sales tax. I don't tip on sales
tax. That's what I would do. Yeah. Like I said, I'm cheap, so.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was always taught. But I do just kind of round to whatever feels right. Like, I don't round up or down. I just kind of like 20-ish percent. It's just kind of it's just whatever feels good. I don't think very long about it. That's where I'm at. If it's really stellar service, I'll do 25%. If it's really terrible service, I'll do 10%. But then the one place where I get ridiculous, and this is you're going to love this, is my haircut. Because I hate getting my hair cut because I hate how my hair always looks. And I've finally found somebody who's ended up being a very close friend, actually, who cuts my hair. And it's funny. I think at this point she doesn't even expect me to tip her, but I do tip her 100%. I don't get my hair cut relatively regularly, and the price of my haircut has gotten significantly smaller and smaller the number of times I've gotten it, because she realizes that, you know, that's what's coming. So, you know, it's, you know, but once again, I built the relationship, and now there's a, you know, and she gets
through money.
Yeah. I know. Well, you know,
I guess it's all right. You know, it's the way the world works.
Well, usually it doesn't end up being somebody who's living with one of my cousins. Okay, like there's somebody that I'm tipping. You know, usually I'm paying for a service, and that's kind of the end of the relationship. So how much I pay is, you know, it's kind of bartering for the quality of service is how I look at it.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I've had a lot of success of tipping well and getting great service. So it's something that I tend to do. As a financial incentive. But you know what this has nothing to do with, James? This has nothing to do with taxes or...
I never did get your effective tax rate, by the way.
I couldn't figure it out.
But it is an interesting topic.
I'll report back to you on next week after I've actually finished my taxes. But this week, what we're here to talk
about... Mine's the same as Warren Buffett, by the way, so that's how cool I am.
Nice. What's Buffett's?
15.
Okay. This week, Like every week, we'll be talking about, technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations dealing back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology they are developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James got a short disclosure he wants to show our way. Throw our way.
Sure. Yes. Something like that. I work for HP. However, I do not represent HP or HP's tax payment systems or any opinions that they may have.
Cool. Awesome. If you want to follow us throughout the week, we post to the social media websites like Instagram and Tumblr and Twitter. Mine too are Instagram and Twitter. My Instagram is NextWiggin4, as in Andrew Wiggin. That's what I'm referencing. And then I'm also on the Twitter at Matthew D. Furlow, a little more traditional in my name selection.
And I am James Furlow on Twitter, on the web, on Instagram, on other places.
He likes to decomplicate it, keep it as simple and consistent.
Yeah, I've even, as far as I'm aware, I have the same profile picture for everything. Consistent brand strategy. That's what I'm about.
And you know what? It's
brand,
hey, man.
Identity.
It's better than what I'm doing, but I'm like,
yeah, whatever.
I'm trying to date girls, so it's, you know, it's more complicated.
Okay.
It's not about building a brand anymore. It's about being attractive. You know, it's stupid. I hate the internet.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
It's and it's not. And then if you want to go, if you want to find out more about the show, like all the articles we talk about, videos that we show, music that we play, anything like that, we also have the show clips, the whole show, for the podcast, and the YouTube video. All of that is at furloughbros.com. That is the center of our universe. All revolves around it. And our digital universe, our real universe, revolves around the universal center, which is, you know, at the origin point, I guess.
Which will be talked about next Sunday. For some of us, as early as sunrise. For some of us.
No, I see where you're going. I was like, what are they talking? Are they revealing something about the Big Bang on Sunday? I thought that was like 3 weeks ago, but I got what you're saying.
There you go, transition out of that one.
Yeah.
All right, here, I got it. But let's rewind first back to last week. You dropped a massive teaser last week.
I did.
And which was that you had an eye appointment. What was that, Wednesday?
Tuesday.
Wednesday? Nah, I feel like it was earlier. Tuesday.
Definitely Tuesday.
So how did your eye appointment go?
My eye doctor appointment? Monday.
I was careful not to say doctor, but eye appointment.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Go ahead.
I wasn't careful because I just told my boss, I need to go to a doctor's appointment, an eye doctor's appointment. I lied is what I did there. My boss doesn't listen to the show,
which we do not recommend or condone.
Yeah, totally bad.
At least I don't.
I don't recommend or condone.
I don't want to tell my boss about it, and so I wouldn't be able to.
Well, you know what my rationale was? I sat there and I said, I'll probably eventually tell him about it, and I'll just pretend like I did it one night after work. So what are we talking about here? Last week, we've been obviously one of the topics that I've been kind of obsessed about over the past couple of months with the show has been the Oculus Rift and virtual reality technology in general. I'm pretty stoked on it. But as excited as I am about it,
echoed you every single time you said that? I'll just echo you, and that'll be our way of communicating the immersive 3D-ness of it.
Yes, it's perfect. I'm sure that won't get annoying at all. Sphinx. That was that was a reference for people who watch The Venture Bros.
I don't even know what that is.
It's a great TV show. What was it called? So yeah, I like your stereopic echoing there for the Oculus Rift.
Oculus Rift.
So the deal was, I have a buddy of mine, one of my good fraternity brothers from college. We were hanging out last weekend, and we were talking about the Oculus Rift and game development topics and all sorts of things. Thank you. And he asked me. He said, "So do you get motion sick when you use the Oculus Rift?" And I was like, "I wouldn't know. I've never used one." And he said, "You never used one?" He was super excited. And so he told me to come on, swing by his office sometime this last week and try one out. So I'm going to give my review of the Oculus Rift. And
Oculus Rift,
more importantly, Sixth Sense Technologies. So Sixth Sense is something we never covered. It came up a couple times, and I almost threw it in, but I think it never made the final cut of all the articles we talk about. How Sixth Sense works is they're basically these handle things. Google it really quick if you want. If you're listening, you're like, what the heck is he talking about? They're basically game controllers, but they're really, really spatially aware game controllers. They have all sorts of orientation information, location information. And you hold them in your hand, kind of like you'd hold a pair of guns, and the thing tracks it like crazy. Sixth Sense technology is pretty cool. I was pretty excited about it. They made me want to get some. I actually had me play a game of a modded version of Portal 2 to try to get used to the controllers first, because they bring me in and they're like, "So we got to set up the demo because it's kind of been broken down and we got to do some stuff really quick." But it's all right. You don't have any idea how to play this game because it's a completely new control system, so we're going to get you used to it first. So I'm sitting there playing Portal on my lunch break, doctor's appointment, and like moving stuff around with these, and what they're
they're fixing whatever. Okay.
Right. And all right, with you. Keep going. So I was using the Razer Hydras, which, for people who don't know what that is, they look and feel like oversized Wii nunchucks tethered together, like two of them, and they do motion control stuff. Pretty sophisticated. They're pretty good at tracking what you're doing. What Sixth Sense is building is, I'd call it a competitive product, but Razer doesn't make the Hydra anymore, so like Sixth Sense is the only place in the world you can like buy them from anymore. So they're kind of.
So wait, this company that you were at, that's what they make, or they were just using that technology?
They are developing a very similar type of technology.
When
you play a game using their stuff, it works just like you were using the Hydra. So they kind of
understand
this demo, So basically, they were having me get comfortable with the controls, because obviously if you've ever seen the Oculus Rift, there's no way to see through it.
Rift.
You put it on your face and you're blind to the rest of the world, which is part of the fun of it. And so you kind of have to know what you're doing already, whether they're handing you a gamepad or a keyboard or whatever. So they give me these two. So I play this game for a while, having a good time, and then they sit me down. And basically, they've modded a Dev Kit 1, which is the ones that aren't quite as spatially aware as the Dev Kit 2.
First one.
Yes.
Okay.
They've modded it with a bunch of like open level of electronics on top of it. And I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to be telling you any of this. But whatever, they don't listen to the shows yet. Oh, maybe, I don't know. Maybe they will now. I didn't tell them we do a podcast is the one thing I probably should have mentioned. Yeah. Anyway, so they basically broken apart their controller, put it on your head, attached it to the top of the Oculus Rift. So you got all this cool motion tracking stuff, similar to what you have going on in your hands. They put on the Oculus Rift, turn on the demo, and boom, you're in this gun range, and you've got these two hands, and it's super cool, because as you're moving your hands around, you can't see anything, but they're moving in front of your face, like, you know where it is. Everything's in the right place.
So, like, as you're moving, can you see, like, fake hands holding the gun?
At first, they're just, like, hands out in front of you. You pull the triggers, and the hands close. Yeah, so it's just, like, they look like your hands just out in front of you, but now they're like these digital robotic hands, right? And
that's weird. Matrix-esque.
Kind of, yeah, actually very much. So, and I'd say the first couple of minutes of playing it, like, it didn't really occur to me, like, okay, this is cool. And it was just sort of getting adjusted to it, and, like, I can move around in the game because these controllers have joysticks on it. So you can kind of use those as your dual analog inputs. So not only does your head tracking work, so you can look around with just your head, but you can also move around with your thumbs and to do more macro movements, right? Whereas all your head is your more minor adjustments, right? So anyways, I roll on up to the front of the gun range where the guns are, and they tell me this is how you pick up the gun. I pick up the gun, cool. Pick up the other gun, I can fire.
So like they're just talking to you next to you telling you what to do, or
yeah,
they,
I don't have any headphones on. So they're just standing out in the office talking at me. And we grew up in
watching on a screen, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. They got theirs. They can see what I'm seeing. They just can't see it all awesome like I can. Mm. So one of the things that I think is interesting is that we grew up in a family that's unafraid of guns. We did hunting as kids, been to gun ranges, done the whole thing, gone out to the mountains and fired off handguns and everything. And so I've had some training in marksmanship. I'm not good at all, but I've had a little training in it. So there's some habits that I've picked up that are good. One of which is I have a tendency to automatically close my right eye, keep my good shooting eye open, my left eye, and aim over the barrel of a gun. And so I get this gun, and I just kind of instinctively did that, and I aimed, and I fired, and I hit the target. And then I switched eyes to the other gun because I'm dual wielding, and I fired, and then I'm firing all around. And I was like, it took me a couple seconds to realize that worked and why that worked. And that was really kind of exciting and cool and unique, because what basically happened is, like, since I got two different views on the Oculus Rift, in the monitor, if you get both, you get all your normal data that you'd get that your eyes would be fed with in the normal world, which throws off your ability to aim. You close one eye, you get rid of half of the conflicting data. And because it actually, the game is designed to not, it's got basically two different cameras. One of the cameras, the right camera, is lined up over your eye, and so everything lines up right, and it aims right. And it was just like, it was really, really cool. And I was like sitting there, and after I'd been in the game for about 5 minutes, all of a sudden I like stopped, and I just looked up, and I looked around, and I went, whoa. Well, I really feel like I'm here. And they all started laughing at me, and they're like, yeah, it goes, it takes a couple minutes, but everybody has that moment where finally they kind of settle into the controls of it, and they can just look around, and it really, like, it sinks in, like, what it is and how good it is.
That's cool.
And one of the things I think was really astounding to me was that the graphics of this demo are terrible. I mean, they're like advanced N64 graphics, maybe like early PlayStation 3. They're bad graphics. But you don't even really notice, because everything's right. Everything is like stationary where it's supposed to be when you move your head. Everything stays where you'd expect it to in your periphery. Everything has the right depth. Everything is where it's supposed to be. And so the lower quality of the graphics is almost just kind of like a – I don't know. It doesn't even matter to your eyes. It would take me a long time, I think, to really care a lot. And then this thing has the extra motion tracking involved. So as you like tilt your head and move your head around, it's even better at tracking, what your head is doing, and all the cameras stay in the right place. I mean, it's super sophisticated in what they're doing and just what they're tracking, and it just looks great, and it's really cool and really awesome. And at one point, I'm like, I'm holding this gun out in front of me, and like I take the gun, and I'm looking at the side of it, and then I twist it around, and I look down the barrel of it, and then I pull the trigger just because, and I shoot myself in the face. And again, they start laughing at me because they're just like, yeah, you're like – everybody who like plays with this game, you let them play with it long enough, and they eventually shoot themselves in the face. I was like, "That's funny. At least I'm normal." But I was gonna say one of the things that I thought was really, really impressive is like, it's virtual reality has some sort of a romanticism to it that I think gets people really excited, even if it doesn't live up to that. And oftentimes it's really disappointing. I think one of the reasons why the Oculus Rift has gotten so much attention is because it kind of lives up to it. It lives up to And in my experience there, man, it totally surpassed it. I was really blown away by how really and truly, when they talk about that sense of presence, how quickly I slipped into that. It was just kind of there. Which is really cool and really a unique experience. It makes me really excited to spend all of my money on all the equipment required to get this thing going. But I thought one of the most important things I sat there and I said, you know, if you've got as I'm sitting there, I'm thinking all sorts of different questions, right? Because I'm trying to put all the different pieces together. I don't want to just be a passive observer and go, well, that's really cool. I can't wait to play some video games. I want to think more. What's next? What's bigger? And so one of the big things that I took away was I totally get why Facebook got this. I mean, the idea that a concert, really? If you were to, oh yeah, you were to make a concert where you basically have one of Google's, one of the Google car cameras for Street View mounted onto a chair. So you get 360 degree view of everything going on. And you do that with like a sound sensor that has all the sound sensors. So your headphones are attached to the same, you know, head tracking data that you're getting from the Oculus Rift, and you can look around the auditorium, and all the sound changes right with your head. I mean, you would just be so there; it's not even funny. It would just, oh man, it would be crazy. And if you're playing, if you're doing that with you know, different sporting events or movies, I mean, it could just really, really change how you experience that sort of thing. And you know, really, you know, in ways that I don't think people have really sat there and went, this is game changing. And I get why Facebook's sitting there saying, we don't know what comes next. We're not sure where exactly this is going to be find use, but what we can tell you is that if this becomes affordable, not only will it be used in video games, but it'll be used way, way, way beyond that. This is really this is unique. This is not something anybody's ever played with before. And it's just it's an exciting little experience to have, to have gotten to, you know, a piece of that, especially because they told me I'm like the first person outside of the company that got to do the current level of the demo, which makes me feel really, really special, and it's probably bad for my ego. But
yeah, that's all right.
Yeah. You know what? I'll take the risk. And the other thing that I sit there and I say, you know, from a game perspective, how do you build game mechanics that make this, that really take advantage of this? And there are just a couple of thoughts. Number one, the aiming mechanism I thought was amazing. That was really cool, really unique, something that you've never had in any video game before. Granted, that's not just the Oculus Rift, but it's also not just Sixth Sense. It's a combination of both technologies that made it really, really cool and unique, and I think would be really fun in a game and challenging and give you some new dynamic. But the other thing that I was thinking, like, is just kind of how it orientates and how orientation works in the game. Man, one of the things that I thought was really trippy was when I would move around in the room and the voices all around me would stay stationary, or vice versa, they would walk around while I was just doing normal stuff, and having that kind of dually conflicting information, because you're eyes are convinced you're not moving, or you are moving, you know, one of the two.
Yeah.
And your ears are convinced the sound is coming from the same location. So it's it's kind of, you know, you're kind of in this like two world area. I was thinking, like, one of the cool things that I thought in video games was the first time I was like storming the beach of Normandy and a bomb goes off right next to me and it does the big sound and then it goes quiet and gets just the ringing and kind of the giving you that sense of being disoriented with an explosion. I was like, man, yeah. You are going to be able to really, really mess with people's orientation. If somebody like punches you and you're like, you're Batman and Bane punches you in the head and all of a sudden your entire screen starts to like get blurry and drag. And then they have like, if you were to take the sound and have the sound switch in inverse to what your ears are doing, you'd throw up. I mean, you'd have to be careful how disorienting it would be.
Do stuff where you are getting people to fall over, like physically fall over, because you can start to move the screen I guess you have to do it opposite, right? Where the screen starts to move forward, and so your instinct is to pull back, and you're just, boom, falling over. because you got hit. You know, I mean, that's interesting. I also think, like, I can't remember if we talked about this a few weeks ago or not, so I'll bring it up again. But this idea of how you can have a movie or an experience that is independent and different for every single person, where you get that on, and whatever you're looking at or focusing on at that time is what you're seeing. And so if you wanted to focus on something going on in the background or on the side, you could. And if you wanted to, you know what I mean? And so so you can see different aspects of different movies, or like you were talking about, different events or things like that. That would be pretty interesting. I also think there's opportunities there for, you know, for the business world. You know, I'll be honest, my mind goes there pretty quick. How can you do virtual meetings? Because I do those all day. And it's like, man, if you could figure out a way to make that feel more live, that would be pretty cool.
The last piece of this, all I wanted to kind of tie in, was an article that I saw earlier this week that was about filmmakers making realistic CG on the fly. This filmmaker invested in this $14,000. He had a rig with $14,000 worth of graphics cards in it. And basically what they did is they bring it into this this motion capture stage, and he has his actors doing his thing in their motion capture, like, you know, tight suits with the little balls on it, like you've seen for any, you know, movie. And basically what he did was he would walk around with what looks like some sort of a tablet attached to the handles of, like, if you've ever seen them making, like, movies where they have the dual handles for Steadicam stuff, instead of a camera, there's just a tablet there. And what he's looking at in the tablet, that tablet is being motion captured too. And what that's doing is it's giving him, this is the camera angle that we're capturing of what these two guys are doing. And so effectively, he's looking through this, and it's able to wirelessly send the image of what's being captured as they move around. And what was really interesting is that he basically was like, with this rig, with $14,000 worth of equipment, we can't render the entire thing live. I mean, we can't. Unfortunately, the algorithm's too complex. But what we can do is we can render a lower resolution of it, which allows me to kind of see the action, follow the action, so we get a really accurate, I'm able to see what the camera, I want the camera to be doing. And he goes, and then we can spot check it. So they can pause it for a second, and in like a second and a half, they can render the actual image using the same algorithm that they're going to be using when they send it to a rendering farm to do the whole thing, and to a server farm to render the whole thing. So, like, this is a still frame, full resolution. This is what all the lighting will look like. This is what all the textures will look like. Everything's done. Everything's right, which is just a fascinating. So he's able to do these really, really well, great live, you know, moments. And it's funny. I sat there watching that, sitting there going, okay, that combined with an Oculus Rift. I mean, when we talk about, like, the holodeck and building the holodeck, okay, so we're what? 5 years away from like that, like, just not even joking, is full-born, you know, built and done. And it, I don't know. It's just, I mean, honestly, in 15 years, that will be a normal thing. I gotta believe, because it just is, you look at everything that he's doing, you're like, this is incredible. This is amazing. This is so friggin' cool. And it's, I get it, and I'm ready to spend some money. Sony, it sounds like y'all are going to be up first. The best part about the whole experience with Sixth Sense was, because they're building stuff that doesn't compete with Sony or Oculus Rift, they were able to render a valid opinion, I felt. And they were like, yeah, just go with the PlayStation 1 when it comes out. They're like, it's, you know, basic. If you don't have anything, if you don't have a computer, you don't already have everything set up, if you have to buy everything fresh, just go with Sony's. It's probably going to be the cheapest, you know, like, way to get a decent setup. I was like, all right, I trust you. So
interesting.
Yeah,
that'll be fascinating to see if the Oculus goes more of that open source hacker route, which, I mean, it very much feels that way, where Sony's going to put together a finished, complete system. Yeah. It probably won't be as good. But like you said, you could pick it up, take it home, and within an hour be playing.
Yeah.
And that probably will not be the case with the Oculus for a few years.
Right, right. So, oh, very cool. Very cool experience, you know.
Thank you, Sixth
Sense, for letting us do it, and awesome products, awesome games, and, you know, I don't mind. I won't want to spend some money later on in life when I'm rich and famous.
Yeah, we're working on it. Very cool. Yeah, that's cool. There is no way to transition to this next one, so
just go for it.
I'm just going to do it. We're switching over to the car industry and the complications of the car industry.
Okay.
And we know about Uber and we know about Lyft.
They
both do the driver thing where you got a car, you want to earn some money off of said car without having to get your taxi medallion. You can you know, give rides, ride sharing stuff with your cars. Nice. One of the problems that they are having, not a super surprise here, is getting drivers. You know, it's kind of the equation has to work on both sides, right? You got to have people who want to ride, and you got to have people who want to give a ride. And right now, their biggest pain point is driver supply, if you will.
Hmm.
So there is a company that might have solved that problem for them.
Okay.
But at the same time, opened up an entire new can of worms. There is a company. Their new name is called Breeze. They were called, looks like Zephyr Car, but now they are Breeze.
I've heard of Zephyr Car. Yeah.
There you go. Well, they are now Breeze.
So all right.
Easy breezy. These guys are, they're crazy. How do I want to describe this? I'm trying to find where the actual thing is. So essentially what they're doing is...
Did you just explain it? I'm dying here.
I know. I'm trying to figure out. I mean, even I'm kind of like, wait, you guys did what? So what they've done is they found an investor, a mysterious unnamed investor, okay, who is leasing to them, to Breeze, new vehicles, which they in turn are renting to willing drivers, mm-hmm, who then have signed up for Lyft and Uber to drive other people around. Does that make sense?
Okay, give me that one more time, because I was...
Yep, distracted, but it's confusing. All right, so what they did is they have a mysterious unnamed business partner
who owns
some vehicles.
Okay.
That person is leasing Breeze their vehicles. So Breeze doesn't actually own anything. They're leasing vehicles, much like you could lease a car from a dealership.
Right.
Now, Breeze is then renting those cars to individuals, much like a Hertz would do.
Okay.
Except those drivers are people who are willing to drive for, you know, Uber and Lyft.
So what I would be, so just so I'm active listening. So basically what happens is I would say I want to make a little money on next Saturday night. So I'm going to go up to San Francisco. I know that people are going to need rides. I know that later in the evening is like the craziest time. And so I go up to the city. I hit up formerly Zephyr, now what are they called again?
Breeze.
Now Breeze, and I call it Breeze, and I say, hey, I want to do the driver thing. So I'm going to pick somebody up. That person is going to pay me money through Uber. I'm going to take that money. I'm going to get a key portion of it. I'm going to give it to Breeze, who I'm renting the car from. Breeze is going to pay it to somebody else who they've leased this all from. And then the dude that owns all these cars is going to do whatever he does with all that money and sell able to, you know, get cray and have fun with it. Okay. All right. So I think the obvious question becomes, so when I accidentally get in an accident and kill somebody, whose insurance pays for it?
Yeah. Isn't that the question?
That is the question
of the day. Yeah, they don't. That's and that was part of this article. They were just like, "This is crazy." They were talking the chain of liability is kind of how they're referring to it, which my guess is at some point everybody pays. Lyft and Uber, they're currently trying to figure out their insurance situations. They both have coverage that you know that they extend to people who are driving at the time.
Right.
Now, you know, taxis are like 24/7 protection. They own the vehicles. You know, I mean, there's like they're really good. So it's not quite to that extent, but yeah, they're trying to figure it out, and no one knows. And they're kind of like, well, we'll wait until someone gets in an accident, and then we'll tell you what happens, kind of thing. Is kind of where they're at, but pretty crazy. Like, and on one level, they're like, honestly, Breeze might have figured something out. And if Uber and Lyft are smart and this actually starts to work, they should just buy a fleet of cars and rent them out to people.
Yeah.
And just eliminate the middleman altogether on this one, you know, or acquire them and, you know, as a thank you, I suppose.
Would be as a thank you. Yeah.
Huh. You know what I mean? They get credit.
I want to know. You know, I want to know who the dude is that owns all the cars. That's like decided he doesn't want anybody to know it's me.
Well, you know, he's not dumb on that case. Yeah, apparently these guys, the founder Jeff Pang, they had a Craigslist ad out about the whole rent thing, and Pando actually like came across it on Craigslist, and so they called them. We're like, hey, what is this? We're always looking for stories, and they were like, oh, it's just an idea. we haven't figured all the details yet. We're still honing in our logistics and testing what works. We'll tell you about it later.
Oh man, that's
and
funny.
So it took about 3 months though to figure it out what it was. They said that the first thing they did was they maxed out all their cards the first few days to buy some starter cars in their fleets.
Yeah.
And they said, the trick is you have to do it all on one day before it hits your credit.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's horrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they so then they found an investor or partner, I guess, to buy the vehicles and lease it back to the company. But yeah, just kind of a crazy chain. It must mean that there's a pretty good margin involved in all of that, too, to make that work out. You know,
well, I mean,
the returns be good enough for everybody.
I don't want to get all like, you know, crazy and everything, but basically they are competing against, ultimately they're competing against the taxi industry, right? And the taxi industry is a, you know, although there is competition within the different cab companies, especially in cities like San Francisco, LA, and Seattle, where these companies really have started and have bloomed. All of those, and the reason why these things exist is because there was effectively no competition. They'd all colluded together with the government, and they passed laws that made it impossible. And that was the purpose of the medallion, is it makes it impossible for a newcomer to come in and charge whatever they want. So they get to keep prices high, and they all kind of agree, hey, this is what we're – you know, none of us are going to undercut each other, and we're going to – and buy – because of that, we'll be able to charge the maximum that these people are willing to pay, as opposed to, you know, paying, you know, as opposed to allowing quote unquote free market capitalism to drive down prices. So it's one of those things where, yeah, there are great margins in the taxi industry. That's like the point. and so it's not shocking to me at all that, you know, that effectively, you got four people taking bites out of this thing at different levels and different percentages, and it all ends up, you know, everybody makes money at the end of the day. Yeah, tell me something.
There's a person where she says Breeze charges $25 a day rental fee plus 25 cents per mile.
Okay.
Says she makes about $17 to $18 an hour after the cost of gas, and Uber and Breeze both take their cuts.
17 an hour?
Got 25 cars right now.
That ain't bad.
You know, if you'd like to drive and you don't got anything else going on.
Yeah, man. That's good money on a Saturday night. Come on now. do like that for 4 or 5 hours? It's like $100. That's not how I'm going to spend my Saturday nights.
Well, that's the trick, right?
Yeah.
But well, I can see. I mean, that's better than minimum wage, I suppose.
It's a lot better, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's a decent deal. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I work full-time and get paid better than that. For me, it's like, you know, it's easy for me to say no. But, yeah, if I were working minimum wage, I was still working on Arby's Roast Beef, and you were willing
Which
to offer
delicious
me –
delicious place. Just
delicious. And you were going to pay me an extra $100 just to, like, you know, drive people around for a couple hours on a Saturday night up in the city. Sure, yeah, sign me up. I'm down, you know. And I could easily see getting into that, especially if it's not going to cost anything, quote-unquote, to my car, you know. And, yeah. I could see that. I could definitely see that. But
yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool little deal. It's going to get very messy at some point in time. You know, we talk about who's at fault with the driverless cars and all that stuff. And just wait till that comes on board. We'll just throw that into the mix too.
One of the iRobot stuff. One of the things that it does concern me is that, you know, the taxi industry's argument is that, yeah, sure, it's cheaper for the end user, but there's complications that it's a safety thing, and that I am concerned that if this gets complicated enough and it gets messy enough, fast enough, that it'll give politicians who are well compensated for their activities the leverage that they need to say, no, you can't do this anymore, which is somebody who, you know, is frustrated by things like that, because it's like, you know, you got a bunch of people who are willing to get crazy, and, you know, and me as a customer who's willing to say, hey, you know, I can choose a cab or I can choose Lyft. Well, let's try Lyft out, you know, and where there's some real innovation and stuff moving forward and just explosions of changes, and good changes, not just cheaper, but just better, like, you know, better coordinating of where the taxes are coming, better apps, better, you know, better pickup, better service. It's just so many things are better. And I shrug my shoulders and I say, like, that's frustrating that might go away if people get too hinky with it. And hopefully, you know, you got responsible people trying to do the right thing legally with insurance and everything. And, you know, like you said, you know, we'll sort all that out the first time we have to. And hopefully there's smart people there who are, you know, willing to kind of usher it along. And that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah. I hope so. I hope so too.
Yeah.
So there was other news this week.
There was.
Big news that kind of dominated all the headlines all week. For as boring of a thing that it is, it was big news.
Well,
I still don't fully understand it, other than once the XKCD cartoon explained.
Yeah.
Which is totally accurate, knowing him.
Yeah. Randall's pretty dang good at that sort of thing. So actually, it's funny. I am proud to say that I felt like I understood it before the XKCD comic came out. I read the XKCD comic and said, yep, that's what I've been led to believe is going on. So basically what happened was, if any of you have been paying attention at all to anything, there was
even a not paying attention. It's impossible.
I know, really. So Heartbleed is what it's called. Has to do with OpenSSL. So when you're if you're on Chrome doing anything, you know, that little lock thing in your URL, HTTPS. What does the S stand for? Secure, or something. But kind of secure. That's where they're going. But that little lock, that green thing, that's basically saying that there is a communication, an encrypted communication between you, the client, and Google or your bank or whoever, the server.
Yeah.
And that information is encrypted. There's all sorts of keys going back and forth. Everybody's having a good time. Everybody's happy. And so you could get, you know, sensitive things like banking data or passwords or, you know, emails or whatever over the internet, and the NSA could intercept that data, but they couldn't read it because it was encrypted, so it didn't matter. And that was the advantage of, or, you know, bad guys or whatever.
Bad guys.
Yeah. The same Russian name, mob. Right? Yeah, I was going to say. I, you know what? I did that on purpose because I know the NSA listens to us. So basically what happens is it's just the security protocol keeps everything covered. Part of the technology, so one of the ideas with OpenSSL is that SSL is a kind of a – it's a it is a security protocol of how things are going to talk back and forth, right? Everybody will meet this protocol. How you do things behind the scenes, how you do things on the server, how you actually formulate the words. So if you're open – SSL is the language you're going to speak. It's the secure language. How you actually formulate the language, you can build your own software to do that, and you can call it whatever you want, which is what Apple has done, or you know, buy it from somebody or whatever. Or you can use an open standard, and one of the advantages of the open standard is that anybody can see it, anybody can look at it, anybody, and you know, specific people are allowed to edit it over time. But because everybody can look at it, everybody can say, yes, this is secure. So Google's a big advocate of that sort of a thing because it basically allows them to be double-checked. And the cool part about it is even if you know the mechanism of how it works, if it is executed properly, it's still secure. It's still you can't decrypt it without the encryption keys. And one of the fundamental elements of this thing was what they called the heartbeat. Once you start a communication, once me, the client, starts talking to Google, the server, once you start talking to Google, the server, you create this connection. Every once in a while, y'all have to talk to each other in order to make sure, hey, you still there? Like if you get distracted and you're not like, you know, currently doing things with your bank, a word, a message is sent to the server, and the server responds, and that's the heartbeat. There was a bug written into the heartbeat.
Not on purpose, right?
Not on purpose, or so we think.
A bug.
Yeah, and it's. I'm pretty confident that it wasn't on purpose, simply because, simply because we know who wrote the bug. Like, we know who's responsible for it, and it's just been sitting there forever, and it's kind of like it's one of those things where it's like, it seems, by all intents and purposes, a heinous, unbelievable bug, but a bug nonetheless.
They've happened before.
Exactly. And what's interesting about this is
Apple knows about that. Oops, yeah, there's just one here. We'll try that.
And you know, it happens to everybody, and it's not good, but it's So basically, what happened was, functionally, what you would do for the heartbeat action is you would send a phrase, of whatever. Hey, how you doing, server? For example, or let's keep it easy. Hey there. You would send that. Hey there, H-E-Y space T-H-E-R-E is 9 characters, right? Each character has 8 possible bits. So you'd say, hey there to the server, and then you would tell the server, by the way, my message is this many bits. This has this many bits in it. You'd send it to it. And then the server would get that information. It would know how many bits it was. It would decrypt it. And there's a lot of advantages to sending that sort of information. You're going to decrypt it. You make sure you send the right amount back. You know how much you're supposed to get. That's a really normal in when you're doing a communication handshake. You send your information, and you send how much information you sent. So the server gets it and says, okay, I got how much information I was supposed to. It looks at it. And then the second half of the heartbeat is it responds. Well, its response is it sends the message back with the information about it. It basically rebounds it. And then you, the client, you get it back, and you sit there from the server, and you say, okay, I sent hey there with 6 bits. It sent back hey there with 6 bits or whatever, and or 9 or whatever. And it now I know that the communication. I know that the information's being sent. I know that the communication protocol is still established. I know everything's good and everything's working. But this is the thing, and this is the bug. the server in OpenSSL, the heartbeat actual execution, didn't check to see how much information it was supposed to send back. Basically, what it said was, we trust you. If the client says it was only 6 bits long, then I trust that it's only 6 bits long. And so if it's at least that long, cool. And then it returns that 6 bits. But if you said it was 16 for some reason, the server trusted you, and it would get that, and it would send the last 16 bits of information back, the 6 that you sent, plus the next 10. Now, where does that 10 come from? It literally is in its RAM, in its stored memory, and that could be anything, but it's basically the next chunk of RAM it would send that to you. And since that was all kind of stacked at the top, your last thing was the last thing it did, it would give you in reverse chronological order everything it's given. And it turned out that for the heartbeat, you could send like gigs and gigs and gigs of information about this. But what's even more frustrating, you could basically get the server to dump its RAM back to you through the heartbeat. What's more frustrating about this is there's no log of the heartbeat. The heartbeat just kind of happens, and it was always supposed to happen. And so if you sent information, so if you made a secure connection with the computer, you could just say, hey, now give me everything that you just did. And everything that it just did, it'll dump back, whether it was yours or not, or the last person that was on there. And what's even better about it, and even more awesome, is sort of because of how this whole communication protocol thing works, and how the heartbeat works, if someone were to inject a packet into there, because you're, you know, surfing from Starbucks, the server doesn't necessarily know, and if you just inject a heartbeat that asks for it to dump its RAM back to you, it'll do that. What gets even further, what's even more complicated, is a lot of people initially said that's not possible. That's not how OpenSSL is written. OpenSSL has all these breaks in it, and that's the sort of thing that would just break it the moment that sort of thing happened. So they dug in even deeper, and it turned out that the heartbeat was built into a different layer of OpenSSL that basically was like designed to kind of ignore a bunch of these breaks. It was bad code written with a bug in it. I mean, it was just one of those like, wow. And nobody picked up on it because it was just something that worked and everybody trusted it. Well, that's not entirely true. At least one organization we're sure of did know about it and has known about it for like a year and a half, 2 years. And guess who that was? Yeah. What do you mean it's not true?
They came out with an official public statement that said they didn't learn about it until everybody else did.
You're going to trust the NSA with this sort of a thing. Let me put it to you. This is kind of my opinion on the NSA. Basically everything.
Where did TechCrunch get their information from?
They got it from Bloomberg, I think it was, or Reuters. It was one of your big like. It was one of your big boys, like not just off the cusp, It's not just a tech blogger, but an actual like research paper. They're journalists. And
Bloomberg.
Yeah, and you sit there and you go, and it's one of those things where I reference back to the Eddie Snowden versus the NSA, right? Basically, everything that the NSA has said in regards to that has turned out to be blatantly and completely false. Everything Eddie Snowden has said about that has turned out to be true as we investigate further. So just. Okay, maybe the NSA wasn't lying this time, but history would suggest that it's impossible to tell if they were or not because they're really, really – their tendency is to lie about this sort of thing. What I think is – what I do sit there and my kind of opinion on it, you know, because like instantly you've got news reports flying around. Change your passwords, change your security stuff, change everything, like blah, 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 blah. You know, you're starting to get the chain mail stuff. And then people saying, but don't change it yet. Change it, but don't change it. Change it, but don't change it. I think one of the things that people, like, forget here is that, okay, the servers would not be able to keep track of if there was a breach. That is a valid argument. So there's no way to know ever. But the thing is that this is like a really obscure book. Like this was really obscure. And if anybody was taking advantage of it, I have a feeling they would have taken advantage of it a lot. And I get the sense that this is one of those ones that's like a horrifying security breach, but nobody even thought to try to take advantage of it until it became public knowledge. It's sort of the problem that Microsoft ran into with their security updates. They would find these huge vulnerabilities and, you know, these zero-day exploits, and they'd be horrifying. But if nobody was currently exploiting it, they wouldn't rush out a security update. Because if they just packaged it in, like, the middle of one of their traditional security updates that came out every Tuesday on Security Tuesday once a month, then nobody would think twice about it. They would just – no one would even look at it, and it would be patched before anybody even realized it. They would only push out security patches if there was currently a botnet being built. If there was a big botnet that was gaining momentum and taking over a bunch of machines, then they would push out an emergency security patch. The problem was is as soon as they put that out, it was like a big – like big banner. Hey, guess what? There's this zero-day exploit, and anybody who hasn't updated Windows XP is completely vulnerable to it. Speaking of which, XP is no longer supported unless you're, you know, paying big bucks for it, so get off XP because of this problem. this was like a big banner letting everybody know this is an exploit now. So really and truly, the most dangerous time to be, like, the only dangerous time from what I can tell, and I'm sure security researchers who are super paranoid and only spend money would tell me I'm being an idiot, but I think realistically, you're only were at risk from the moment that the announcement was made to when all the patches were made. And they started back-channel talking. The company that found and named it the Heartbeat and found the bug, they started telling everybody, all the big players like Google and everybody, and beforehand, like, hey, guess what? This is coming down the pipe, and as soon as we're going to get it, it's incredibly important that we announce it right away. So they probably only got a day to know that it was coming. But the patches were made quickly, and they were updated quickly. And I'm willing to bet that virtually no information got compromised in this whole thing. Because it's just one of those things where it's, you know, it's not just is it technologically possible, but it's people have to know, and the right people have to know, and to kind of mobilize and take advantage of it. And the worst part about this is that you're talking about a RAM dump, which, like, it'd be pretty easy for some kid to accidentally stumble upon this bug and realize that he can get these servers to dump, you know, get Google servers to dump their RAM. But it's a completely different thing for them to be able to go in and actually sort through all of that and realize that, okay, these are the encryption keys. And there's not, you know, it's not, you're not talking like the only vulnerable information that would be there is like what you recently did. Those encryption keys were the most important ones. And that was the scariest thing is it's like what information was actually being stored there. Well, maybe your bank information, maybe all of this, but parsing that is difficult. That's not exactly, you know, that's not really super easy to just kind of come up with that information. And you're talking about, are you getting lucky? The most dangerous thing possible in this whole thing is this is the scenario. The hacker knows how to do this. He's recording all of your – he's intercepting all your packets. You're in Starbucks surfing your bank account. He's intercepting all of your packets coming back and forth, recording all of that data. He then does a heartbeat, picks up the security key, and then is able to go back and rebuild your entire history of that. That's the most coherent, easiest way for them to actually get information. And then hopefully somewhere along that lines, they pick up your password. And now with your password and all of your security data, they can get into your bank account and steal all of your money. Unless you're like an incredibly high valuable target, nobody was getting their information stolen this way. There wasn't, you know.
So you're saying you didn't change your passwords?
No, I didn't. I'm totally vulnerable. If you know my passwords, go ahead, steal all my money. I dare you. You're not gonna get
so
much.
Email password the same as your banking passwords?
No, I have done. Yeah, I've in the last year or two, I've actually done a pretty thorough job of. I have like six different passwords that I use now. My bank password is the only place that I use that password. And it's weird. It's like, it's not easy to find. And then I've got other versions of my easy ones for websites that just have my personal information. Cause I don't, you know, whatever. Facebook sells that anyway. So how much do I care? Who can get access to it? The only places that, you know, and then there's like different levels of money sites, and, you know, Google has its own different set of passwords, but whatever. What am I supposed to do? Like, you can't just live in constant fear of this stuff. Be mindful, you know? It's, I don't know. This is the worst kind of thing, because it also it's obscure, it's difficult to understand, and the media loves this kind of thing. Just get everybody all riled up. It's, you know, it's the perfect kind of news story. It's conflict.
Yeah, why not? Like I said, it's a huge news story that's ultimately just in the weeds, boring.
Yeah. I think the technological part of it.
We are fully updated and secure, by the way, for those of you listening. Your podcast is not at risk.
Yeah.
Of the bug. Mostly because we don't use OpenSSL. So,
it's true.
So it's all good.
I thought that was funny that, you know, Apple managed to, so they had their little tiff with security stuff being all messed up earlier, a couple weeks ago that we talked about, yeah. But they completely skirted this one. They were like the only company that used their own SSL stuff, so they were completely invulnerable, which was pretty.
There you go.
Nice job, Facebook. High five. So I don't know. I think it's interesting. I like explaining it because I think it's interesting how this technology works and that kind of security stuff and kind of the politics of it and everything. But yeah, ultimately, you're not at risk.
Well, it just comes back. People don't like to be surprised.
Yeah. You know? Right.
This was a surprise, and they will continue to happen as we become more dependent on human-made software.
Yeah. Eventually, the AIs will take over, and it'll be exciting. Man.
Then we'll really be in trouble.
Yeah.
So in other news, did you know that less than 99.99% of TV viewers actually make a TV show?
What?
Okay. We'll say it another way.
I'll say
99.99% of TV viewers
have
never made a TV show.
Yes.
Have you ever made a television show?
No.
All right. Good. Neither have I.
Okay.
Because I don't think this counts as a TV show.
So we're part of the 99.9%.
Just put it in context, this next stat.
Okay.
44% of Twitter accounts have never posted a single tweet.
Wow.
So they're doing better than TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Though one could argue the barrier to tweet is slightly lower than the barrier to create a television show.
That is true. And I would argue that I don't know anybody that has a Twitter account that has never tweeted that actually reads tweets. That's
the question, right?
I'm going to say those are inactive users or really strange birds, man.
Well, so that's the interesting thing here is Twitter defines active users as anyone who is logged in at least once a month. Of those people, 44% of them have never tweeted.
There are people log into Twitter at least once a month.
That's how I am reading.
Never tweeted. All right. That's cool. That is fascinating. I'll give it to them.
These are estimates done by two charts.
Can you read tweets without logging in?
I don't know. Yeah, you have to log in. I mean, it has to know A, what you're reading, and B.
Well, not necessarily. I'm gonna try this. Let's go. Let's see here. I'm gonna go. I follow Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Fallon.com. Okay. I'm going to go to the Twitter.com And so I've got his URL. I don't want to publish anything. I want to log out. I think I remember my login information. Sign out. Okay. I've now signed out of Twitter. I'm taking the copied URL for Jimmy Fallon's tweet. And that's okay. So, yeah, that's what I thought. You can read Jimmy Fallon's tweets without logging in. Okay. Why the heck would
you can read without logging in. I'm sorry. I thought you said retweet.
No. So, yeah, good point. No, I see what I see the confusion. See, now that doesn't make any sense to me because you don't need to log in to read them, but you are. But you are. Just to read. Who are these people? I want to meet them. They confuse me.
I like this. They were saying that there were some so they started to ask the question, does this mean Twitter is just still too hard to use? You know, and there are people out there who are just like, I don't get it, I can't use it. I want to read, maybe, like you were talking about, select things.
Yeah.
But I don't want to use it. And they're like, if the comments at the bottom of the Wall Street Journal piece are any indication, like, maybe one of them, Dave, what the heck is a Twitter? Is that like a MySpace? Yes, classic. I love it. This one, I would guess that most high post Twitter twats are narcissists. What moron posts their daily mundane life story on the web for everyone to see? It's a great question.
Yeah.
We don't post boring, mundane stuff. Get over it. And then, what do you expect? Twitter is for twits, and it's dying a slow death. So all that to say, and these are all, like, right in line, there are still people out there who don't get it. But you're like, but they signed up at some point.
Apparently. Yeah.
So that's just all part of that broadening concern that is Twitter, their growth is slowly static and not growing. So one of their responses to solving this problem, perhaps, is a new profile page.
Nice.
Twitter. If you signed up brand new today, you would actually get it. But because you and I did not, it's going to take a couple weeks for it to get to us.
It doesn't matter because I can't sign back in. I can't remember my password.
Oh, there you go. So it looks a lot more Facebook-esque, actually.
Yeah, okay.
So you've got, instead of that little picture that's behind your picture, you have kind of that, what's that big picture on Facebook called? The almost the panorama-sized thing. What's that called?
The
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the banner, the headline, the headboard. We'll get there eventually.
It's not your profile picture.
It's above your profile. Well, it's kind of embedded behind your profile picture. It's your cover.
Twitter's got
it's your
one
cover
of those.
Photo.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, thank you. That hurt. Everyone is screaming at us right now in their cars. So that you can have a cover photo, and then you also have your profile picture, which, slightly covers, goes in between the cover photo. And then you have your tabs of, like, your tweets, your followers, updates, that kind of stuff. And then you have your stream, and then on the side of your stream you have, who's recommended for you, trending stuff. It's got underneath your profile, it's got your name, your bio, some links to it, you can search out stuff, and then the people you're following and people following you, their pictures. So it looks very much like a Facebook timeline.
Yeah, seriously. And,
right? With the embedded pictures now. And
yeah, that's crazy. It looks just like Facebook. What the heck, Twitter?
Yeah, so the guesses are that's part of their, like, they're trying to get people, recognizing that there are a lot of people who just don't tweet and want to just read stuff, and therefore this can become more of a landing page for that. And then B, people are clearly a billion people are comfortable with Facebook, and so they can make it more Facebook-esque. That will make the onboarding process a little easier as well, and hopefully start to turn some of their numbers around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. You know, if they can just keep all the Tumblr stuff and BuzzFeed articles off of my feed, that would be fantastic.
I don't know what your problem is, man. They were supposed to actually get rid of a lot of that stuff, and it looks like they did on mine.
I don't know
why you're getting all that junk spam on Facebook.
I get so much junk. It's unbelievable. It's like, I'm not baby crazy, and can I get some babies as opposed to more garbage from BuzzFeed? I hate BuzzFeed articles. They're so uninteresting. Oh my gosh. I got CNN.
You
know, it's my friends. I gotta say,
I'm liking them.
I gotta say, the problem is my friends. I realize it's my friends. I have bad friends. I have uninteresting friends. Y'all are boring. And
sounds like you need new friends.
I do need new friends. I'm trying to
start hanging out at different bars, tipping different people.
I know. Well, see, those aren't the bad ones. It's the problem is that I've got a lot of friends. And like
the problem is I've got a lot of friends.
I know.
It was just silence after that.
Facebook, yeah. Facebook has a difficult time sort of like coming up with something, you know. I feel like there's probably a sweet spot for the number of friends because it's kind of like Pandora. If you put too many seed songs in, eventually it just completely degrades its ability to predict new songs because it's like, we don't know what you like. And
you like everything.
Yeah, exactly. And it becomes difficult. And Facebook, I'm sure, has a similar problem with their algorithm that at some point it's just there's too much information. Trying to figure out what's actually pertinent to you is coming from many different sources, and our algorithm kind of breaks down at a certain point. And you know, I sit there and I go, I don't come here to find out what my friends are interested in. I come here to see pictures and like read their tweets. Like, I don't want to read the articles they're reading. I really don't. I feel bad saying that, but like, seriously, I probably already read it. That's actually the worst part is that it's not even necessarily that it's uninteresting. I've already read this sometimes 7 years ago. Like, this is as old as the internet, guys. Like, really, come on now. Come up with something new.
This is as old as the internet.
Whatever.
I got to listen to a debate. It was a very short debate. It wasn't that interesting. About the value of the internet and if it's bringing people together or pulling them apart. It was interesting.
Is it?
Well, just in the sense that one person is very much opposed to it. And saying that it is destroying society, and the other one, no.
What was the context of this debate?
Somehow we were talking about technology, and I was talking about Facebook to start
with. Like at work?
No. This was this afternoon at a church thing. One kid was a high schooler, and the other one was a college student, actually.
And which one said that the internet was destroying the world?
You want to guess?
Yes. I'm hoping that it was the college student said it was destroying the world and the high schooler said, no, it's the savior of humanity. Is that kind
of
fits the... Okay, all right. I was going to say, because...
Well, and the high schooler goes, look, he goes, you're right on the bubble of people who grew up with the internet. He goes, it's a part of my life. It's always been here. It's... Oh, man, make that college kid feel old.
Wow.
Love it.
Wow, yes. You're right on the bubble. You know, it's funny. I actually think...
I felt like we were on the bubble, but apparently not. That was a big bubble.
Seriously. Well, it's okay. So this is the ultimate answer, is that when you go to college, you get your eyes open and you see injustice in the world. I mean, this is the classic, you know, college freshmen are super annoying. Why? Because they suddenly realize that there's a bigger world than what they have. See, the high schooler, all he's ever experienced is the internet. The college student's the same, though. He grew up with the internet, fundamentally. And all of a sudden, he gets to see a world. He's forced to experience a world where maybe there wasn't an internet, and maybe it could be better. And he's like, if we were just to give up all technology, it would be better. It'd be so much greater. And then at some point, you learn, and you realize that the thing is that it's so foundational that it's you can't get away from it anymore. Like, yeah, it's not perfect. There are really terrible sides to technology. You know, understanding how to split the atom is simultaneously the greatest source of power and the greatest source of destruction. These things aren't all one thing, but as a college student, you're taught to think that if there's anything bad in it, it's all bad. And which is something that hopefully you grow up out of and realize that the world is complicated, and that's part of what makes it fun and exciting. And, I like that. But what's interesting to me is that both of them were sitting here saying, no, it's one thing. It's either good or it's bad. And you're like, no, it's not, it's a little of both, actually. it's kind of awful and kind of amazing.
That was essentially my answer. I went, well, there's a balance to everything.
Yeah.
And it can be good. It can be bad. It is kind of what you make of it. And you probably should have offline real relationships in addition to your online relationships. Probably shouldn't be one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are times where it's good to be on Facebook, and there are times where it's good to
texting
check out
Facebook.
Texting
is a good thing. Wait, yeah. Is that internet? Oh, man, now I'm confused. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I
yes,
like technology.
It is.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's funny. I had an interesting conversation this week about the nature of reading and writing and how it's like how wrong we were. Well, like how we thought we were, you know, like 10 years ago, it was like obviously video is going to be like just going to destroy the written word. And it is more important today to read and write and spell better and properly and quickly than it has ever been. And it becomes acceleratingly and at an accelerating pace, it becomes obvious that unless something majorly changes, it's becoming even more important to be able to type, read, and write. And do grammar.
Well, you know why, right?
Because it's the quickest way to discern, to parse information.
Yep. You can read faster than you can listen. Or
yep.
Someone can talk, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, and so it's which is
and
why
you don't have to have your earphones on.
Yeah. And it also from the writing perspective, you don't have to it's easier. It's easier to put together coherent things and read and you know or
yeah,
and
well,
write.
You're taking away communication, right? You don't have those other subtle indicators anymore, so it is easier.
Yeah, that's a big one. But it's interesting because it's like it's easier to write because you can do it slower, and it's easier to read because you can do it faster. So it's the best of both worlds, as it were. And but it's funny that like you know this like fundamental understanding of how technology works or how human beings it's an answer. I feel like an anthropologist were probably screaming for the last two decades. No, reading and writing gets more important as the technology gets better. And all the technologists were like, no, video is the way to do it. It's going to be super fun when it's videos. No.
Well, and maybe and that depends, right? There are some things where I mean, just like video is so much better than the written word. You know, I think about like home repairs or car repairs,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
That kind of stuff. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Give me a video any day of the week.
Yeah.
So much better.
Pictures worth 1,000 words, right? I mean,
yeah, and videos are worth millions of pictures. So,
yeah,
you know, that is honestly when I have a project, I just go straight to YouTube and start to search. I don't even look at tutorials anymore. You know, so that's huge. So there are cases where that's you know.
I guess my point is that it's yeah I think but we were lured into this idea that would all go to video because the TV was such a romantic thing and everything seemed to be going that way and then the minute you actually get information overload all of a sudden you know I don't know it's interesting it's really really fascinating these kind of twists and turns and you know of how did we get here Twitter like.
So
I want to bring it back
Twitter,
around. Yeah,
I'm gonna jump. Here. Matt Mullenweg had. This can make it hard. Because I apparently. No, not gonna work. Interesting. Here, give me a second.
Want me to do one? Are you frozen? Oh, bummer. You're gone. Okay, so I'll keep on doing this. So, oh, jeez. James has been disconnected from the internet, and I believe that we are still live. So I will tell you all of our listeners about charging your iPhone in 30 seconds. This is pretty cool. If you listen to the show, obviously you'll know that we are.
Oh, are you there?
Hey, hello. There. How you doing? So I was going to move on to something else, but you're back, and I didn't really get into it. So talk to me.
Okay.
And don't do that again.
Yeah, I don't know what I did there. I was trying to search. You're still there.
I am still here.
All right. Did you hear anything? I'll just start over.
Go for
it. So Matt Mullenweg is the...
He figures his life out. We'll do it. I'm moving forward with my story. And
I'm still here.
I know. Are we talk? Is it okay? Is it Google? Is both of our like? Are we talking over each other, or are you like full on disconnecting? Because
I completely disconnected from the old internet. Apparently.
Okay.
For no reason, and then you know, then as a result, then like we're like, whoa, are you sure you want to end the broadcast? And I was like, no, I don't want to end the broadcast.
Okay, well, obviously the NSA.
I'm not actually recording this.
I can say the NSA. Well, see, I've been live the whole time, so everybody keeps getting my eye at half the conversation. So the automatic. So I'm gonna continue on my story.
Hopefully. What?
Well, yours balances out. Anyways. There's this company in Tel Aviv. They're able to charge your cell phone in 30 seconds. Pretty cool. Tel Aviv, Israel.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Can we do that, or do we have to have whatever they have?
We gotta have whatever they have. It's a special battery made with organic stuff in it. I don't actually know what that means. Right now it's big old base that like it's like half. It's like twice the size of the phone. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Mm.
They claim that it gets the full milliamp hours and that they're going to be able to shrink it down. And obviously this would be really cool for your phones because it would negate one of the biggest drawbacks of phones. And if you can fully charge a phone in 30 seconds, you might be willing to draw the battery down faster, not make it last 24 hours because what the heck, you just throw it on a charging station for 30 seconds. So they got some advantages there, but where everybody gets really stupid excited is in batteries. Tesla, you know, does it make sense for electric cars? And if it's a scalable technology that can provide for electric cars and you can charge a car in a couple of minutes, that's a game changer, as it were. Suddenly range obviously becomes far less significant if you can just plug it in for a couple of minutes and be on your way. So pretty exciting little piece of technology going on. So far, nobody seems to be calling baloney. And I'm sure I'll be following this one. In Tel Aviv, they want it. They want to be building it into phones and like by 2016. So it's not one of those. It's not one of those. Sometime in the next 10 years, we'll be able to make this profitable, which is the same as saying never. Usually in this sort of a thing, they're talking implementing it very quickly and effectively. So it's cool. All right. So what were we talking about?
Oh yeah. So we were talking about Twitter and kind of what they were doing in the written word versus video, and Matt Mullenweg had a quote, who is the CEO and founder of WordPress. And, you know, they power a ton of different blogs.
Yeah, around. And he also owns the best URL for my name, and it drives me crazy.
That's true. That's true. He's got long flowing hair now. He's kind of going down the hippie bend. Looks good on him, though. Looks good on him, I think. His quote was, oh, where was it? Where is it? Oh, yeah. The world cannot live on 140 characters alone.
Huh.
There you
okay.
go. Which was his Jesus flowing hair. He says that one. So as a result of that belief, they have purchased the company called Longreads. And essentially, it's a Twitter account. And they promise to find the best storytelling on the web. And so they link to articles that are more than 1,500 words long.
So 3 pages.
There you go. And so they try to find just great articles from underappreciated websites along with more well-established publications. Let's see here. I haven't actually looked at their Twitter feed. So what do they got here? Font Wars, Inside the Dissolution of the New York's Preeminent Type Foundry. The Last Hand-Me-Down, Retracting My Brother's Life Through His Clothes, or Retracing. Oh, that's interesting. Suffering Children and the Christian Science Church. The Business of Books, A New Reading List by some person. Naked and Famous, a profile photographer, Ryan McGinley. And then finally, for now, Why Soda First Became Popular. It wasn't just the cocaine.
Didn't hurt.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm probably going to follow them now. Yeah, so their whole goal is to find long, interesting stories on the web for people to follow. So they're a curation company. And if you want, you can get their subscription that costs $3 a month, and it gives you daily recommendations, or you can get a weekly email for Frizzle. And so it's one of those
$3 a month
things
for their like daily updates?
Apparently. Yeah. Okay. Or subscribe to their Twitter feed for free.
I read so much already. Jeez.
Let's see. What is let's see here. They did one 4 hours ago, 8 hours, 11, 15, 15. Let's see, on the 12th they did 1, 2, 3, 4.
On the 12th day of Christmas.
1, 2, 3. It looks like they do somewhere between 3 and 4 posts a day.
That's like 12 page. That's a lot of pages, man. I don't have that kind of time.
I'm just giving you a flavor. You don't have to read all of them.
Good, because I'm not going to. But, I don't have time.
Well, and that's the issue, right? Like you just said, you read a ton of articles and you don't have time for it. And so we've talked about this before, there is this push to help people find what it is that they want to read when they have the time to read it. You know, this whole idea of helping people curate the web, because there is so much written word being created. And and that's something that Matt and WordPress, you know, they're like, no, we get it. There's a lot going on, a lot of great stuff being created. I mean, they help power all sorts of crazy stuff. They power Business Week, you know, Bloomberg stuff. They also power the New York Post, Quartz, and Time. You know, so they're like, we get it. There's a lot of great content being created, and so they're trying to help start that. You know, that curation process, above beyond, you know, outside the 140 characters.
Right. That's cool. I mean, that's really cool. I still kind of hate him, but it's really cool.
Well, you know, it's for good reason. There you go. Definitely. Followed.
I'm
done.
Yeah, terribly mature, I understand, but.
I feel like you add them to a list of some sort, but I don't know. Do you have an opinion on Twitter lists? Do you use them?
I don't. I'm terrible. I check Twitter like twice a week and kind of just do big intakes of it all. And
back when Flipboard was actually useful because it integrated with my RSS feed, there's feedback for you. I actually, not only did I have Instagram, and so I'd flip through my Instagram pictures pretty regularly, but I had specific Twitter lists that were set up that I also had on Flipboard. So I would actually flip through those lists fairly regularly.
Yeah.
And now that, you know, because I was already there and reading the news anyways, and so typically I'd look through some of the other ones. And I love Flipboard for that reason. Now that they don't support, you know, Feedly, which is a shame, I just don't use it anymore.
Yeah.
And And so that's kind of a bummer. But otherwise, because I used to.
Yeah, I think I should figure that out. Maybe there's a service that I use that it would make sense where Twitter just kind of gets sprinkled in. Because my biggest problem is I just don't go there. It's not one of the places my thumbs, you know, find, you know, wiggles its way to on my screen on a regular basis. Although it's right next to Facebook, which should make it feel bad. Because I go to Facebook too much. So
I have certain people who I get notifications for that I follow, and you know, and so I see those, and so I'll visit Twitter to you know, to see those, but that's about it. Right. I don't do any of the other ones anymore, and there were genuinely good ones. I've got some cool lists set up for myself, but anyways, that's a different subject altogether.
For sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, I got one last article to scream through. I'm gonna skip the rail guns, although I think those are the coolest guns out there. Maybe for a different day. We're gonna talk about, so this last week, somebody brought to my attention an article about the
someone being me, by the way.
Yeah, it's all right. How thin flexible electronics will revolutionize everything from user interfaces to packaging. Cool. It's pretty cool. There's a big old conference in Berlin, the ID Tech's Printed Electronics Europe show in Berlin. Kind of just state of the art, what's out there. So one of the things that they talk about, this is awesome. I'm actually really excited about this. The one of the big takeaways was this sensor thing that basically it's a sheet of what is it called? In this setup, you have a sensor and you would like laminate it directly to a picture. Is what the example they're giving, and it combines Plastic Logic's flexible transistor technology with Isagore's organic photodetector technology layered on top. And basically what happens is the photodetector is the size of the picture. And so it does this direct scan of this picture that you're putting things onto. And this is really unique because obviously we can take pictures with you know, current technology. But it always has a focal length. Effectively, you can't put the sensor directly onto something and scan it. It has to be set back to some degree. And this is effectively saying, no, we can have a one-to-one. Each scanner pixel can scan a certain area. That's awesome and all, but, well, you know, like, why would I scan pictures that way when we have all these other cool ways of scanning pictures, like, I don't know, taking pictures with a camera? Basically, one of the big things is that they sit there and they go, because it's thin, because it's transparent, you can build it into all sorts of different stuff that you never really thought of before. So one example they give is, like, you take a screen, like a classic monitor, you tear off the screen, you put this sensor scanner as a layer in between the screen and your glass, you put the glass back down, and all of a sudden your entire monitor is a scanner. So, like, you could take a picture, let's say, of, like, you're on your desk, you're drawing something, you pulled it up to your screen, hold it there for a second, pull it up, and now it's got that image that you drew. Now, that's kind of cool. You're like, All right, I can see where you're going there. But they take it one step further, because they're like, well, basically, this is a picture scanner. So if you were to put your finger onto the screen, it could take a picture of your finger, which is effectively what Apple's Touch ID does, is it just takes a picture of your finger.
Right.
And so they're like, it turned the entire screen into that kind of a technology. And if the, you know, if the resolution was high enough, you could do fingerprints. But what's even more important there is if you can sense a one fingerprint, you can sense a finger or a whole bunch of fingers. And all of a sudden, you've turned every single all of these different control devices into touch-sensitive stuff. And more importantly, because it kind of can see, it actually has a bigger range than just what's touching it. You can even do it from a distance. So from a short distance, you can kind of get a little bit of a depth field in there. So you can, you know, you don't have to just touch things. But it's one of those things where it's like, you know, instantly, what can we do with this? I'm not sure. But long-term, what can we do with this? Probably cool stuff. Another example they give is they have a tablet that they've put this into, and they have these cards that, in this example, they're cars from Pixar's Cars and the movie. And they have, like, the back of the car card has some sort of like a image on it. You put that onto the screen with the app open, and it can look at that image like it was a, you know, QR scanner type thing, except it's not a QR code and you don't have to hold it back. You just put it on the screen and it registers it, and all of a sudden you can verify. So yeah, so they're talking about this sort of thing as like a way to interact with it. I'm excited about that. I think that's really cool. I think that you know, different ways that we can involve even more sophisticated ways of, you know, not just a camera, not just a touch sensor. That stuff could really change how, you know, we interact with apps, interact with computers. And if it's cheap and affordable, oh man, that gets pretty exciting. This thing was really cool, though, because they just got into, like, they got into all sorts of, like, different ways of printing stuff. One company printed electronics. They can print electronics onto 3D surfaces, and the example they gave was they printed a circuit onto a wine bottle. And we did that because we didn't know what else to print, quote. Great. That's really cool. Nice job thinking of something creative. But they talk about the idea of, like, you could see a more, you know, a really cool, like, microcontrollers and stuff. If you've got an example they said is, you know, wine bottles need to be kept under certain conditions in order for them to be aged properly. And we just kind of do that, you know, where there's not a lot of sophisticated involved in that. There's been a lot of trial and error, and we've kind of figured out what's best. Well, all of a sudden we're like, well, now right onto the bottle, we can print these circuits. So we can put sensors, we can put microcontrollers, we can put temperature, humidity, and we can see things. We can send optical things looking into the wine and ask, what is the wine doing under these different circumstances? Or you could do stuff where, like, you could print onto individual test tubes, stuff like that. So it's cool, and it's one of those things where you're like, there's a part of me that's like, I'm surprised we haven't been able to do that before. But at the same time, like, well, why would we ever have done that before? So I guess that makes sense.
True.
So they're coming up with cool things like that and just moving forward. And what's cool about this is that these are not revolutionary technologies that you're instantly going to go out and want to buy these tomorrow. But these are like the technologies that you're going to start to see kind of just embedded in everything in the next couple of years. Another one they give examples of, and I've always wondered why we didn't do this, is this company – basically, when you press a button, so you're like in your car, you know how you have your little, like, your little dongle, you press a button, locks the door. I've always asked, why don't we have little, like, piezo, like, things in there that basically when you press it, it generates a little bit of a current, and we, like, use that to charge, you know, recharge the battery or something, right? Well, the answer is because it doesn't generate enough electricity. It's such a small amount, it doesn't. It's useless. Or so we thought. Because there's a Swiss company, they're specialist Algra. They operate using piezoelectricity. Basically they build these little sensors that's exactly what they do. They're powered by the click itself. They're basically a little transmitter. So you click it, and that's what generates the pulse that is, later read by something else. So it's
actually battery free. Your click exactly is what powers it to send out the signal.
Yeah.
I love it.
And what's cool is that that suddenly gives them, you know, they can start to build that sort of thing into things that you'd never want to replace the batteries on, like, I don't know, a couch, you know, something like that, where you
remote control, a mouse, keyboard.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a mouse and a keyboard are a little bit are bigger. You're talking about a very small pulse of energy. Okay. But it's like you can start to you can confidently build that into something that before you never want to because okay. It's cool. Cool stuff going on. It's exciting. Yeah. Exciting world.
Cool. The world is exciting. I would agree.
I agree. I agree that you agree. Agreeing, man.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Hey, man. Awesome show this week.
Yeah, you too.
Awesome show. A lot of good stuff going on. I like it. The bugs have been fixed. Twitter is turning into Facebook and other stuff going on. thanks for sharing with your Oculus story too. That was cool.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure to be able to try it out.
I'm sure it was. Take one for the team. Do the research.
Hey man, anytime you ask. It's funny. The last thing I said as I walked out was like, they were like, man, it was really nice having somebody actually try it out. And I was jokingly, I was like, well, if you ever need somebody to try it out again, just let me know. I'll show up. And they're like, We might take you up on that. Oh my gosh, please. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Please, take my money now. Yeah, exactly. I understand. Very cool. Very cool. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. My name is James Furlow, and my what are you? You're my tax evading brother, right?
Yes.
Is that what you are? Because you said you haven't fully filed yet.
I'm mostly done.
It's coming up, man. Today's the 13th. It's coming up. So that guy is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time. Thank you.